Chapter 3. The Economy, Stupid. As the 1990s began, public fury over inequality was beginning one of its great cyclical eruptions. For the 20 preceding years, pundits and politicians had hoped, predicted, and declared that the egalitarian impulses of the Depression years had been cured. Instead, the economic effects of Reaganism made their revival inevitable. The rich were richer than at any time since World War II, while small farmers and manufacturing workers were seeing their livelihoods destroyed. The cult of the entrepreneur had produced a group of buyout artists and savings and loan owners who were little better than criminals. The stock market had been galloping along at a tremendous pace until the crash of 1987 suggested the whole thing was built on sand. The former Republican strategist Kevin Phillips kicked things off with his best-selling 1990 book, The Politics of Rich and Poor, asserting that upper-bracket excess could only go so far before it triggered a populist backlash, and that America had now reached that point. The book was filled with the now familiar sorts of charts showing how income inequality had accelerated over the years and how the top percentages were pulling away from everyone else. "Only for so long," Phillips wrote, "will strung-out $35,000-a-year families enjoy magazine articles about the 100 most successful businessmen in Dallas, or television programs about the lifestyles of the rich and famous." The following year, two reporters for the Philadelphia Inquirer published an even more bitter account of how the wealthy had plundered the country's productive enterprises during the 80s, pushing the nation toward a two-class society. In 1992, the series appeared in book form under the title America, What Went Wrong, with a then-shocking inverted flag on the cover. It, too, spent many weeks on the bestseller lists. A typical passage fumed that in 1989, the top 4% of all wage earners in the country collected as much in wages and salaries as the bottom 51% of the population. Mull over the numbers carefully. The top 4% of America's workforce earned as much as the bottom 51%. That is in wages and salaries alone. Class outrage was in the air. The 80s boom had soured into a sharp recession in 1990. But the president at the time, the patrician George H.W. Bush, seemed less than concerned. In December 1991, General Motors announced plans to close 21 plants and lay off an astonishing 70,000 workers. The month after that, TV news footage showed almost 10,000 people lined up in the bitter Chicago cold for 1,000 job openings at a new hotel. In the presidential campaign then unfolding, economic populism was the flavor of the moment, the clear way to voice the spirit of the times and to challenge the uncaring, high-born incumbent. Four different candidates in 1992 struggled to make themselves the favorite of the discontented voter. The one who pulled it off most convincingly was the young governor of Arkansas, Bill Clinton, who preached the old-time religion with everything he had. Not only did Clinton wave a copy of America, What Went Wrong during his speeches, but he talked like its authors, too. "Middle-class Americans now worked harder for less," he would say. 1% of America's people at the top of the totem pole now have more wealth than the bottom 90%, he liked to add, calling it the biggest imbalance in wealth in America since the 1920s, right before the Great Depression. Indeed, Clinton said, "we were now facing the danger of raising the first generation of Americans to do worse than their parents." When he was finally offered the nomination of the Democratic Party, he accepted it in the name of the hard-working Americans who make up our forgotten middle class. Then he added this, "When I am president, you will be forgotten no more." It was the kind of campaign that old-style Democrats loved to run, a hard-time set piece in which a clever commoner squares off against a bored grandee who yawns at the suffering all around him, a man who actually checks his watch when asked a question about the woes of the common people. It was the election of 1932 all over again, with Bush standing in for the hated Herbert Hoover. The fieriest rhetoric of all came from one of Clinton's chief surrogates, Democratic Georgia Governor Zell Miller. 12 years later, Miller would appear at the Republican convention endorsing George W. Bush and winning renown as one of the greatest turncoats in Democratic Party history. But in 1992, he was still a flamboyant Southern populist, a purveyor of proletarian bombast so purple, he actually began his keynote speech by boasting about the authenticity of his accent and the hardness of his upbringing. He laced into aristocrats, the rich, and the billionaire third-party candidate Ross Perot. He recalled the days of Franklin Roosevelt. He blasted Republicans in classic style. "I know what Dan Quayle means when he says it's best for children to have two parents," Miller thundered at one point. "You bet it is, and it'd be good if they all had trust funds, too." He continued, "I'm for Bill Clinton because he is a Democrat who does not have to read a book or be briefed about the struggles of single-parent families or what it means to work hard for everything he's ever received in life. There was no silver spoon in sight when he was born, 3 months after his father died. No one ever gave Bill Clinton a free ride as he worked his way through college and law school." Speaking truth to weakness. Zell Miller's later career as a double-crosser gives some hint of how phony it all was. The Democratic rhetoric of 1992 may have made you feel like the heroes of the 30s were still with us, standing ready to take up the old fight against arrogant wealth. In fact, their campaign talk was patently designed to create exactly that impression. In truth, however, erasing the memories and the accomplishments of Depression-era Democrats was what Bill Clinton and his clique of liberals were put on earth to achieve. That is not the conclusion of some sour and cynical Clinton hater of which there were once so many. That is the sober and considered judgment of a responsible journalist, Martin Walker of the British Guardian newspaper, and author of the 1996 book, The President We Deserve. Walker was clearly an admirer of the 42nd president, and after acknowledging Clinton's failings, he urged his readers to think bigger. The president's shortcomings were, in the end, balanced and even outweighed by his part in finally sinking the untenable old consensus of the New Deal and the crafting of a new one. Only a Democrat was capable of such a deed, and Clinton did it. That was his great and undeniable achievement. He put the 30s sensibility down so forcefully that it would never again be revived. Let us recall that Bill Clinton came to national prominence as the leader of the Democratic Leadership Council, whose object was to shift the party to the right using whatever ideological tools were at hand. It is ironic, given the damage they proceeded to do to working-class people, that the New Democrats finally got their chance to move into the executive branch as a result of a distinctly populist campaign pounding away at the oldest of left-wing themes. The truth of the New Democrats' purpose was presented by the journalist Joe Klein in his famous 1996 Romana Clef about Clinton's run for the presidency, Primary Colors. Although the novel contains more than a nod to Clinton's extramarital affairs, Klein seems broadly sympathetic to the man from Arkansas, as well as to the DLC project more generally. Toward the equality-oriented politics of the Democratic past, he is forthrightly contemptuous. Old people who recall fondly the battles of the 30s, for example, are objects of a form of ridicule that Klein thinks he doesn't even need to explain. It is self-evident that people who care about workers are fools. And when an old-school prairie populist challenges the Clinton character for the nomination, Klein describes him as possessing a voice made for crystal radio sets, and offering Franklin Roosevelt's jobs program, forestry, road building, to out-of-work computer jockeys. Get it? His views are obsolete. It was like running against a museum. That was the essential New Democrat idea. The world had changed, but certain Democratic voters expected their politicians to help them cling to a status that globalization had long since revoked. However, a true statesman, a real New Democrat, would challenge them to open their eyes. The climactic point in primary colors comes when the Clinton figure visits a union hall in New Hampshire, an obscure local of a dying craft, a fraternal organization for people left behind, as Klein describes it. To these working-class losers, the candidate decides to tell the hard, unpleasant truth. So let me tell you this, no politician can bring these shipyard jobs back or make your union strong again. No politician can make it be the way it used to be, because we're living in a new world now, a world without borders, economically, that is. Guy can push a button in New York and move $1 billion to Tokyo before you blink an eye. We've got a world market now. That's good for some, but muscle jobs are going to go where muscle labor is cheap, and that's not here. So if you all want to compete and do better, you're going to have to exercise a different set of muscles, the ones between your ears. Uh-oh, said the woman. And Stanton, read Clinton, did something really dangerous then. He didn't indulge her humor. Uh-oh is right, he said, and anyone who gets up here and says he can do it for you isn't leveling with you. So I'm not going to insult you by doing that. I'm going to tell you this. This whole country is going to have to go back to school. We're going to have to get smarter, learn new skills, and I will work overtime figuring out ways to help you get the skills you need. That's the magic moment that turns the fictional presidential race around, when the Clinton character speaks truth to weakness. In Klein's cosmogony, this is something noble, something honest, something Democrats must do in order to win. Although this particular story was made up as a description of a certain Democratic outlook, it was exactly right. What workers need, this passage tells us, is to be informed that, in the face of global markets, there's nothing anyone can do to protect them, that resistance is futile, that only individual self-improvement is capable of lifting you up. Not collective action, not politics, not changing how the economy is structured. Americans can only succeed by winning the market's favor, and we can only do that by proving ourselves worthy in school. Klein was right to make this scene the fulcrum of his novel. It raises the basic question of what to do about inequality, collective action, or individual effort. It raises it and then dismisses it with a glib call to go out and get some skills. It's the glibness of that dismissal, the professional class certainty that has been repeated in 1,000 presidential statements and Senate hearings and casual conversations on the Accelerotrain, that explains the Democratic Party's flat inability to rise to the challenge of plutocracy. Every man a yuppie. In reality, remember, Bill Clinton owed his election to hard times and his remarkable ability to make people think he cared about their suffering. With an assist from the plain-speaking billionaire Ross Perot, Clinton succeeded in winning back many of the working-class voters his centrist, technocratic predecessors had lost to the Republicans. Once elected, Clinton expressed his thoughts in a December 1992 speech to his economic summit. Here is how he proposed to deal with the various economic problems he had identified on the campaign trail. Our new direction must rest on an understanding of the new realities of global competition. The world we face today is the world where what you earn depends on what you can learn. There's a direct relationship between high skills and high wages, and therefore we have to educate our people better to compete. We will be as rich and strong and rife with opportunity as we are skilled and talented and trained. I emphasized Clinton's line about what you can earn because it may well be the most important passage of them all for understanding how his party, how our entire system, has failed so utterly to confront income inequality. It's a line Clinton repeated a number of times in the course of his years in government, and here in a single sentence is the distilled essence of the theory that has governed the politics of work and compensation from that day to this. You get what you deserve, and what you deserve is defined by how you did in school. Furthermore, this is supposedly true both for individuals and for the nation. Everyone says this. Barack Obama says it. David Brooks says it. George W. Bush says it. Even Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker says it, by implication, when he demands that the mission of the University of Wisconsin be changed from the search for truth to making people employable. Now, there's a sense in which this is obviously true, a platitude, even. None of us would get very far if we didn't know how to read or do math. Research and development is indeed important. People have to have the right skills before they can run the big machinery. But it doesn't take an advanced degree to figure out that this education talk is less a strategy for mitigating inequality than it is a way of rationalizing it. To attribute economic results to school years finished and SAT scores achieved is to remove matters from the realm of, well, economics, and to relocate them to the province of personal striving and individual intelligence. From this perspective, wages aren't what they are because one party, management, has a certain amount of power over the other party, workers. No, wages are like that because the god of the market, being surpassingly fair, rewards those who show talent and gumption. Good people are those who get a gold star from their teacher in elementary school, a fat acceptance letter from a good college, and a good life when they graduate. All because they're the best. Those who don't pay attention in high school get to spend their days picking up discarded cans by the side of the road. Both outcomes are our own doing. One source of this idea, obviously, was the country's traditional Protestant work ethic. There was also an important contemporary source. A few minutes ago, I described a handful of popular authors who wrote on inequality in the early 1990s, but I left out the one whose views turned out to be the most consequential of them all, Harvard professor Robert Reich, a close Clinton friend who became Secretary of Labor in 1993. On the campaign trail, Clinton had carried with him an oft-consulted copy of Reich's 1991 magnum opus, The Work of Nations, and the plan for job training and infrastructure spending that Clinton announced as a candidate followed the strategy Reich outlined. Like the other books I mentioned, The Work of Nations acknowledged that most of us were sinking while others were enjoying fabulous success. In his gently ironic style, Reich told the story of how the well-to-do, the fortunate fifth, he called them, were engaged in a kind of secession from the larger American community, withdrawing into exclusive suburbs and private schools. Here they were able to shop, work, and attend the theater without risking direct contact with the outside world. Today, Robert Reich is something of a populist prophet and a fighter for economic justice, but in those days, he was a very different sort of thinker. Inverted flag distress signals were not for him. Despite his acknowledgement of rising inequality, he seemed rather satisfied with the way things were unfolding. The Work of Nations appeared to be a critique, but it was, in fact, a long valentine to society's winners, the symbolic analysts, as Reich famously dubbed them, the professionals and consultants whose work was creative and pleasant and intellectual, and who rode effortlessly on the waves of the international market, electronically connected at all times, even as they jetted around the world. While manufacturing workers drifted hopelessly toward history's dustbin, the symbolic analysts were the coming class, the only people who really mattered. "Never before in history," Reich wrote, "has opulence on such a scale been gained by people who have earned it and done so legally." That bit about the winners having earned their wealth is a critical moral point. For some, the social crevasse that began to open in the 1980s was an outrage. For Reich, the success of the symbolic analysts was entirely legitimate. These were creative people who were adding substantial value. They were highly educated. Their innovations were in worldwide demand. They had merit. In Reich's understanding of the world circa 1991, not a whole lot could be done for that part of the population who worked in traditional blue-collar jobs. In the future, people would either have to become servants of the symbolic analysts or become symbolic analysts themselves. Reich assured us that the latter was possible if we dedicated ourselves to spending more on education, infrastructure, and job training. Unlike other dominant classes in history, there was technically no limit on the number of people who could join this favored cohort, who could grow up and sell symbolic analytic services worldwide. In theory, everyone could become a yuppie. A more serious objection is that Reich's plan to put people on the path to symbolic analysis simply missed the point. The problem of inequality was more fundamental than upgrading the jobs people did. During the 92 campaign, one of Clinton's best lines had been that Americans were working harder for less. What he was acknowledging when he said this was one of the basic facts of the decades-long inequality debate, that worker productivity was going up, but wages were not. This was and remains essential to the inequality problem. Before the late 1970s, productivity and wage growth had always increased in unison. As workers made more stuff, they earned more money. But by the early 1990s, the two had clearly separated. Workers made more stuff than ever before, but they no longer prospered from what they made. Put differently, workers were working as hard and as well as ever, they simply weren't reaping the profits from it. Wall Street was. This was a massive and fundamental disorder, but one thing it was not was a failure of education. Had the problem been one of inadequate worker skills, productivity would not have been increasing so fast. The real problem was one of inadequate worker power, not inadequate worker smarts. The people who produced were losing their ability to demand a share in what they made. The people who owned were taking more and more. Today, the separation of productivity from reward is a feature of nearly every sort of work, white-collar, blue-collar, symbolic, literal, physical, mental, analytic, representational, all of us going nowhere while owners ascend the stratosphere. But because it happened to production workers first, it was possible for Democrats like Reich and Clinton to look at the situation and conclude that the real problem was those workers' lousy educations. It was a costly mistake. While this interpretation might have made a kind of narcissistic sense to the well-graduated, it allowed Democrats to ignore what was happening in the real economy, from monopoly power to financialization to labor-management relations, to ignore all that in favor of a moral fantasy that required them to confront no one. In the Clinton view, which would become the standard Democratic view, the only ones who had to change their ways were the victims themselves.